On The Left and the Law this morning with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, they discussed the political impact of the recent Supreme Court leaked document expressing the intent of SCOTUS to overturn Roe v. Wade. Jan and Mike take up the legal reasoning behind this full-scale assault on abortion rights, how that reasoning is likely to extend into other court decisions, and how the abortion rights and reproductive justice movements need to fight back. Jan?
Mike, on May 2nd, the leaked opinion written by Justice Alito in arguing for overturning Roe v. Wade has been described as both shocking and not surprising. As part of a larger trajectory, it is not at all surprising. Abortion rights advocates have noted the death by a thousand cuts to Roe v. Wade in hundreds of laws passed in state legislatures in recent years, culminating in a de facto ban on abortion in Texas last fall that was upheld by the Supreme Court in a shadow ruling. So, Mike, what is your assessment of what is perhaps surprising and not surprising about this released opinion?
Well, what's surprising, of course, is that they leaked it. It's a very, very rare event in Supreme Court history. The last time had to do with matters related to Roe v. Wade in the 1970s. Normally, they're a very buttoned-up outfit and do not give any previews until they finally release it. What's not surprising is that they are squarely overturning Roe v. Wade. What surprises me is how much they rely on absolutely discredited and ancient and misapplied history to do so in such a way that makes The Handmaid's Tale seem not quite so far-fetched.
But before going into that history or as part of it, can you say a bit about that line of argument and the role of history that's been disputed, both the specific history cited by Alito, but also how we use history, how the Supreme Court reasoning uses history?
Well, there is almost no usual pattern. There are a group of cases that say that obviously, in a new world with Snapchat and drones, that the Fourth Amendment and other parts of the Constitution have to be updated. You can't simply rely on precisely what was in effect at the time the Constitution was created. But the originalists, or people who believe the Constitution should be interpreted to mean exactly what it meant to the people who wrote it, have managed to persuade most courts, or most of the justices, most of the time, that enumerated rights are protected by the 14th Amendment only when they're, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition, close quotes. Now, they don't always apply that. For example, in Lawrence v. Texas, where they struck down a state law in Texas banning sodomy, the court overruled an earlier decision, Bowers, which had said nowhere did the word sodomy appear in the original Constitution. And they framed it as a matter of people being allowed to do what they want to do in the privacy of their own homes. And there's a dozen cases extending that to the right of being able to live with your extended family, the right to have contraception, the right to essentially be who you are. The right, it's an extension of the right of privacy, has been really developed since the mid-60s. In the Griswold v. Connecticut case, when married couples were allowed to buy contraceptives. Actually, that was a controversial issue as late as the 1960s.
Can you say a little bit about the 14th Amendment that has been at the center of both Alito's reasoning and criticisms of his reasoning? Because, you know, it was passed by Congress in 1866, ratified in 1868, that extended civil and legal rights for Black citizens who were formerly enslaved. How did that become the grounds for these rulings related to privacy and protection of one's person that included the right to abortion and other rights that are part of the modern era? What was it about the 14th Amendment?
Well, it really began to happen in the 1930s. Until then, nobody thought that the Bill of Rights had any application to the states. But in the 1930s, the Supreme Court was confronted with these violently coerced confessions, particularly in the Scottsboro boys case of Alabama. Confessions, of course, are always a great thing for law enforcement. It has been in the 19th century, an English policeman in India said, "Well, it's so much easier to rub red pepper into some poor devil's eyes than it is to run around in the hot sun gathering up evidence." And people have always thought, if you just club this guy and get him to confess, then I won't ever have to go into a dangerous neighborhood. It's very
because there's something about confessions that has, for many people, a kind of face validity.
Well, they, you know, solve everything. They supply every single element of a crime. The case is closed, basically. So the court held that the Fifth Amendment, which guarantees you the right to not have to be forced to testify against yourself, protects you against coerced confessions as a result of the 14th Amendment, which made the original Bill of Rights and the Fifth Amendment applicable to the states. Well, that sort of opened the door, and then other First Amendment rights, for example, the right of Jehovah's Witnesses to knock on your door, and other Fourth Amendment rights were gradually made a part of the law that applies to the states as well as the federal government. And through the 60s, there was a cascade of applying, like, the Sixth Amendment rights to present a defense, to call witnesses on your own behalf. All these rights, which had previously been thought to apply just to the federal government, actually apply right here in Multnomah County and everywhere else in every state prosecution. And so the 14th Amendment has continued beyond criminal defense matters to include issues of privacy, issues of freedom, issues of conducting yourself as you please, and been continually used to expand our rights. The limits to this has been, you know, the originalists have tried to stop all this by saying, look, the rights they say are not enumerated, not explicitly set forth in the Constitution, can only be made to apply if they were, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. And the court has sometimes blown by that. In the case, for example, Lawrence v. Texas, that struck down the sodomy law, they didn't really talk a lot about that because there have been lots of laws against sodomy throughout our history. They've instead focused on all the applications of the right for people to be autonomous, to be free in their own homes, to conduct themselves as they please. But usually, if you want to get more votes, the more you can closely show that it was rooted in American tradition, the better off you are.
Here we do have an interesting fight that's been part of the whole social history movement, the new historical movement, to not only look at the dominant powers that define history, like the medical profession here, it was very implicated in the Roe campaigns to criminalize abortion in the 19th century. But there's a whole social history of abortion that's been documented by feminist historians and others that traces that history very differently than the one Alito is citing. Indeed, argues that with substantial evidence that abortion before quickening, which is when the woman feels the movement of the fetus at around 4 or 5 months, that abortion was not criminalized and was freely practiced. Women developed as healers, nurses and midwives, abortifacients that could terminate pregnancy. They were advertised in billboards and newspapers, and it was often described as getting regular again, which is still sometimes used as a euphemism for abortion many places in the world. So it's kind of interesting the struggle underlying this opinion that has been with us for a long time, including in the critical race theory debates about how we define history and what documents we cite in how we look at history.
Well, here Alito is flat out wrong. For as long as America has existed, there's been abortions. The glaring historical mistakes he's made are that he overlooks the fact that abortion, that is, up until the quickening, as you describe, has been widely accepted and widely practiced. And that was true until really the late 19th century, when as doctors gained power, before they were like barbers, when they made the same amount of money, but they became very powerful and in the late 19th century and were active in promoting anti-abortion laws.
And anti-contraception laws as well. And so there's this affinity of the right of women to end pregnancies. And I think even though women have done this and continue to do it and will continue to end pregnancies, the issue of doing it publicly and collectively emerged as part of a women's movement campaign, because the criminalizing of abortion also emerged during first wave feminism and was an attack on many expressions of female authority and the emerging collective authority of women. So I think that is also part of this assault now on the rights of women to control their own reproduction.
Well, Alito has cherry-picked from moments of the last millennium. I mean, he has to openly acknowledge that our history actually does support a right to abortion for most of early pregnancy. His draft acknowledges that people made the distinction between pre- and post-quickening abortions, and that abortions were criminally punishable only if performed after quickening. But he says this is, quote, of little importance because at the time of the 14th Amendment in the mid-1860s, quote, he says, 28 out of 37 states had enacted statutes making abortion a crime, even if it was performed before quickening. Well, he's flat out wrong. He, for example, includes Oregon as one of those states. But there is an Oregon decision in the early 20th century making it clear that the state does not regard unnecessary abortions as a crime, or any abortion as a crime that happens before quickening. So it's actually more like 16 states out of 37 had laws that forbade women from getting abortions at the time of the 14th Amendment's passage. So that fits comfortably within the standard of law that will be considered a deeply rooted right, according to very orthodox Supreme Court law, the right to have an abortion before a fetus quickens.
So, Mike, let's turn to what's next and the political avenues available in challenging this opinion, what looks like upcoming basic overruling of Roe v. Wade. How important are the criticisms of Alito's legal reasoning and the shoddy historical documentation of his argument? Also, there's a strain of incredible cruelty and meanness that some people find shocking, not only the ruling, but the tone of it, the disdain for justices that were part of previous rulings, including Roe v. Wade and the Casey ruling. And so how much of these critiques weigh in on fighting the ruling itself and the political train ahead?
Well, they're very important. I mean, Alito is just that way. He's waspish, cranky. He's always been a jerk. That's his mannerisms. And I think his tone is very contemptuous of anybody who's different. But a really striking part that we haven't even reached yet is in his effort to find historical precedent, since he didn't do so well in the first couple hundred years of this country's history, he went back to England and cited Matthew Hale, who was one of the authors of commonly used common law books, 9 times. Hale is the guy who invented the concept of marital rape exceptions. He created the law that said that once you're married, women surrender any right to complain about being raped. This guy also presided over witchcraft trials where 2 people were executed. 2 women were killed on the basis of children who were telling fantastic tales of giant toads leaping around the room and who much later recanted all that. This is the guy who Alito relies on.
So you're saying there's something really important here in a project of exposing the worldview and the authoritative, absolutely, the spirits from the past that we each enlist to guide us in our path through the darkness of the moment. And these are the spirits he invokes that guides this sagacious figure in robe. On the court.
Yeah, he quotes Matthew Hale as describing abortion as a, quote, great crime and a, quote, great misprision. He said that in 1673, you know, 9 years after he presided over a witchcraft trial in which he accepted as valued evidence completely preposterous stories and gave women limited their rights to defend themselves and had them executed.
Well, in
so
all
this is
fairness,
who he relies on.
Yeah, Alito does note in apparently his attempt to counter the idea that he is opposed to the rights of women. He says that women now have political authority to voice themselves in many ways, that they don't need to have their rights protected in the form of abortion rights. So I hope he's right that women have enough political authority and voice to summon collectively in fighting this old, not only Alito and the justices, but this extreme right wing that's resurrecting a worldview that opposes much of what we think of as the modern world and a modern conception of rights. So how do we think about the path forward? I mean, part of it you're saying is to expose the fraudulence of the Supreme Court and its claims of wisely ruling from above the fray of political life, and that the reactionary worldview that now dominates the court. But what forms should that take?
Well, expression for one. I mean, the fact that his opinion is crabbed, it's grumpy, it's nasty, it's triumphant, it's a combination of provincial arrogance that is based on falsehoods and complete errors, like his totals of which states had what kind of law at what time, his effort to fend off the idea that there was, in fact, a pretty traditional and longstanding presence of abortion in this country's history. All this needs to be pointed out in order to first limit it, if not absolutely overturn it, to discredit it so that it will be overturned.
I mean, there's the campaign that seems unlikely to pass a law in Congress making abortion a right at the federal level, but that seems not likely. The fights that are going to unfold in the upcoming political period in the states can include a number of arguments around how abortion rights is tied to other aspects of life. You know, the Black feminist thought in the 1990s brought in reproductive justice as a framework for thinking about abortion rights and sexuality, the right to bear and care children and raise them in a healthy environment. So it seems quite clear that the right wing in this country is also very intersectional, including the Supreme Court. They have a number of decisions coming up where this same worldview will be applied to other issues. So how Absolutely. Do we think in that same intersectional way as the right wing is in connecting these issues to their particular worldview?
Well, this opinion needs to be discredited, and its author needs to be discredited every way possible, for, among other, first to set up an eventual reversal of this, because the opinion, the court does reverse itself fairly often. That's not an uncommon thing. It's not a bad thing necessarily. We all learn as we get older. Secondly, this reasoning is, as you said, it's poisonous in many directions. The same reasoning that led to a variety of constitutional protections about how you live your life, who you live it with, what you do at home, the whole constellation of cases, whether or not you get castrated if you're a felon. They can't do that because of constitutional protections found under the 14th Amendment. And interpretations by this court, they need to be nipped in the bud by discrediting this case as much as possible, because they do want very badly to extend it in all sorts of directions.
And so this fight goes beyond abortion rights.
It goes beyond in every direction, having to do with your own autonomy. The basis of this decision can be used and will be used by these people to limit your freedoms in dozens of ways, which I think argues for really limiting this court, period, taking steps by either court expansion or by simply passing a law saying that there are ways of legislating to protect freedoms that we should start thinking seriously about. So I think it's a multi-pronged approach. We have to attack the decision itself. We have to attack the person who made it, the institution who made it, because they are in every sense reactionary and the deepest bad senses. They're not restoring golden eras of the past. They're forcibly taking us to places where we've really never been.
So just in closing, on May 14th, there are protest rallies around the country, including here in Portland, in the fight against this upcoming Supreme Court ruling, and strategizing about how to move ahead in the fight for reproductive justice. Thanks, Mike. We'll continue to follow this, hopefully reporting better days.
Well, this could galvanize people, and it might ultimately have an effect far different than what its authors intended.
That's right.